Today on Movie World, as it's part 3 of our coverage from the Tribeca Film Festival 2019. It's time for Movie Rollers. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And Yazdi as well.
Movie Rollers is your daily dose of film reviews, movie news and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming or on the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you. And Movie Rollers is brought to you by White Moustache Yogurts.
Yes.
We say that because if you...
Well, A, we love them. We love them. And try and eat them and seek them out whenever we're in New York.
But if you do,
or any big city.
We stalk them. It's horrible.
We do.
We sniff, like, where's White Moustache?
Well, it's funny. We wanted to give them a shout out because we Instagrammed our... And if you follow our Instagram feed, Instagram.com/MovieWallers, you may have seen a little picture that we put up from our last recording session where in order to get our energies bounced up fully for the podcast, we all... devoured, and I'm devoured is probably the word to use here. We all slurped down our White Moustache yogurts, which are these yogurts that we discovered a couple of years ago when we came to Tribeca. They don't seem to sell them everywhere. I think they've popped up in Southern California now, but we
only in Los Angeles.
Los
Angeles.
But what's so special about them? It's the consistency of the yogurt, the taste, the flavors.
Just tasty.
The size.
And you can't get them in San Diego, which is why...
Correct.
We always used to... we land in New York and we're like, let's find a deli.
Correct.
So they're not paying us for this. Just wanted to shout out to them because we did Instagram and they Instagrammed us back and it was kind of a
fun thing.
And I
like their logo, which is a moustache.
Their logo is always makes us smile. So shout out to them. And if you are in New York or LA area, pick one up. But, you know, we certainly get one every time we can get hold of the darn things. And they're not in San Diego yet, so...
Yeah, they're not cheap, but they're worth every dime.
Absolutely. In addition to yogurt, we have feasted at Tribeca this week. We've had dumplings. We just came back from a slap-up Indian meal.
Which was...
Bangladeshi.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah, Indian subcontinent.
South Asia.
Yes.
But
the place was crazy. It was just full of Christmas fairy lights.
It's one
which
of the most
in the shapes of chilies, right?
It's beyond description.
Like you couldn't stand up for the lights hitting you on your head.
We should Instagram that as well because it's almost like, I agree with Yazdi. It's you walk in there and it looks like an instant fire hazard.
Yeah.
There's like I mean,
there isn't enough room to swing a cat.
I would say there's like probably close to 100,000 chili
bulbs, yeah,
strung from the ceiling. They have happy birthday, Merry Christmas, happy
Valentine's
New Year,
Day,
and
happy
Valentine's Day, all on the walls.
All on the walls, so they're prepared for every eventuality and every holiday. And we didn't even make it beyond the first third of the restaurant. And
one of the customers sitting on the table next to us, it was their birthday, and unbeknownst to us, suddenly this Punjabi Bhangra dance music came on, which was singing happy birthday. And one of the lights we were unaware of, because it was one of thousands, started turning round and round. There were little disco lights on top of every table.
Hidden.
It was. It has to be seen to be believed.
And the restaurant was called Milon, M-I-L-O-N.
First Avenue it was.
Again, nothing to do with...
Like First
us,
and Sixth.
But it was...
surreal.
It was so much fun to go in there.
And good food.
Good food, cash-only little place, fun service and just a really strange vibe. Anyway, we aren't just in New York to eat. We are here to cover movies.
I know. Actually,
it's our little Movie Wallers annual food festival holiday indulgence. We did cover an extraordinary number of movies today. After I said yesterday that we weren't going to try and gorge ourselves, we somehow between us managed to cover 7 movies. And those movies are the movies Gully, Stray Dolls, The Short Story of the Long Road, Rewind, Clementine, Flawless, and Georgetown. I think I got them all.
Mm-hmm.
So without further ado, maybe we should just get going with things. These podcasts are running a little long because we have so much to say about the wonderful movies we've seen so far at Tribeca. Was today another good day? Let's start with the movie Gully.
Yes, so Joe and Rashmi, you started off your day today with Gully, which is part of the U.S. narrative competition at 2019 Tribeca. It's directed by Nabil Elkerdin, and it's a U.S.-based film. And here's the description of the movie. After surviving traumatic childhoods and socioeconomic hardships, three disillusioned teens, played by Kelvin Harrison Jr., who was seen recently in the title role in Loose, Jacob Lattimore, and Charlie Plummer, who we know from the horse movie, Something About Pete.
Lean on Pete,
yes. So those three fine actors play the three teens. They reach their breaking points and go on a rampage through a dystopian modern-day Los Angeles. So the both of you saw it. Is this worth your penny?
Oh, my God. So this was tension-ridden from about the second scene right to the end of the movie. And there is so much in here that boils over at times. This movie has so much to say about so many dark things, and I almost found myself wishing it had shown a bit more restraint, because I think there's a mind-blowing movie in here. Had it been a bit more restrained and edited a little bit differently, but that's not to say that by the end of it I wasn't so affected. I was so affected by this movie by the end of it. And a lot of it has to do with the three main leads who, just for their experience and their age, are exceptional. This is a really good movie that I wish had just shown a little bit more restraint.
Is it set in contemporary times, or it's meant to be this surreal, dystopian? It just seems dystopian.
It's dystopian in the sense that these guys are gamers, and it feels like their gaming world, they see everything through gaming eyes. There's like a crossover of...
There's a video game, Grand Theft Auto, and this movie doesn't directly reference it, but it's clearly influenced
heavily
visually, because a lot of the skirmishes that the boys themselves get into are depicted in this video game like way. So, for example, there's a scene involving them acquiring a vehicle, and you know, up on the screen pops up, you know, vehicle upgrade, you know, as it would in a game where, you know, you've now attained a higher status vehicle,
or a weapon. You know, one of them uses their skateboard as a weapon, and it becomes, you know, skateboard pops up on the side of the screen saying bruiser.
Okay,
but it's not. It sort of crosses,
but
that
it's modern day LA.
Yeah,
I guess I'll lead in with kind of my thoughts on this. So it's modern day LA, but it's a very bleak portrayal of LA. You know, the kind of thing that we would have seen in those kind of gang movies back in the late 80s and
early 90s. Yeah,
it's a very unpolished, unkempt, not the fancy neighborhoods of LA, but more of the struggling neighborhoods kind of thing. I mean, I agree with Rashmi here. I think, you know, the movie has a lot of things to say about a lot of things. And with that, you know, comes this level of ambition to cram in an awful lot of themes and situations. You know, we have... I'm not sure I want to go there, but there's a lot of violence. There's some mental health issues. There are
teen pregnancies.
There are
kidnapping,
you know, abuse issues. You know, there's social commentary. You know, there's just an awful lot kind of
education
wedged into a 90-minute running time. But and it initially comes off as very hard hitting and almost angry. The movie, for at least its first half, comes across as extraordinary. It's kind of, you know, the overwhelming emotion I kind of was feeling from this was this kind of anger and rage about, you know, the world and
hopelessness
and you know, to some degree hopelessness. But it kind of ultimately worked for me, because I think, you know, despite this kind of, you know, messy, confused way of throwing all of this stuff into the world, I did find myself with some degree of affinity for all of the characters, and some of them, you know, they're not necessarily good kids, they're not necessarily bad kids, they're all kind of nuanced in their own way, and they all have this kind of heart to them that allows us to ultimately root for them in this.
They're kind
bizarre,
of victim of their
dystopian,
victims, you know, of their circumstances, right? And that's portrayed in a way that pulls you in, like Joe's saying, and gives you not empathy, but
yeah. So
it makes them not hateable. In any other situation, you would hate these characters, but you don't, because you kind of understand the world that they've grown up in.
So, you know, I think ultimately the movie worked for me because of that, because I did find myself, you know, wanting, despite some of the very, very violent things, I wanted them almost to get away with it. I wanted them to perhaps get to a point where they could turn the page, and I was constantly rooting for something in their life to go a little better so that they could get themselves out of the situation. And, you know, again, I think ultimately the movie is very effective for those reasons. The performances are really top notch. I didn't recognize Charlie Plummer, of course. Lean on Pete, who you know, he was one of the reasons that Lean on Pete worked so well, and you know, he carries less of the movie here than he did with Lean on Pete, but certainly you know, very good. And then Harrison Jr. It has a very challenging role, because in part his character has almost no dialogue. His character doesn't speak,
although he's narrating the movie.
It's done to some extent from his perspective, and the other performance is a rather odd little role for Terrence Howard.
Yeah, and Amber Heard.
And Amber Heard,
who was very impressive.
Very, very minor roles, but they deliver what they need to, and again they provide just enough of a you know, they have these key moments in the movie, which again I think do them justice. So I like this a lot. I mean, you know, I find it's not going to be for everyone, but I think it's thought provoking and a little difficult to watch at times.
So
thumbs up from me for Gully.
Me too. Okay, where are we going next?
So movie number two then is, why don't we talk about Stray Dolls? I think, Yazdi, that was what you were watching while we were watching Gully.
Okay, so early in Stray Dolls, a passport is unceremoniously shredded unbeknownst to its owner, Riz, who's played by Geetan Jolly-Thapa, an action that stands in stark contrast to the owner's hopes for a new beginning, which I guess it's saying it's a moody and atmospheric thriller, and a person who's trying to leave India behind. So it sounds very interesting. Yazdi, and it also has Cynthia Nixon in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's directed by Sona Juhi Sina. And I guess she became famous because she actually did a short called Love Comes Later, which premiered at Cannes. And this is the longer version of that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Had you seen this short, Yazdi?
I had not.
Okay, did you know it was a short before?
No, I did not.
Okay, so tell us about Stray Dolls. Sounds very interesting.
So Stray Dolls belongs in the same universe as The Florida Project, which came out a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And like that movie, this one sets its sights on people living in and around a motel. And they're all people who are at the lowest of the low socioeconomic strata. And you have the usual mix of people with mental health issues, people who are into, you know, prostitution to make a life for themselves. And into this particular fold comes the lead character, who is an Indian girl who has escaped from India and has come here to make a life. And we never really find out details about, you know, she has a dark past. We don't find out too much about it, but this particular motel is owned by the Cynthia Nixon character, who puts on, to the best of my knowledge, a very convincing Russian accent, and she supposedly takes her in as a maid at this particular motel through kindness, but obviously she wants to make sure that this particular, everybody in her motel is completely beholden to her. So she's the one who actually shreds her the passport of this girl so that she is forever kind of bound to her. And then it's the story about this particular woman who, working as a maid, makes friends with another girl there who also works as a maid. She's Caucasian, but she is into drugs and prostitution and so forth. And the film essentially is about the efforts of the two of them to kind of break free from the cycle of despair. The movie has a very, very nasty view of America.
Okay.
It views America as this place of opportunists and people who will, you know, churn you up and spit you out, especially if you are vulnerable in any way, be it, you know, not have the economic wherewithal, or if you're a new immigrant, that you will be completely taken advantage of. So it has a very blistering view of, you know, at least that part of society. And the movie is a little rough around the edges, but I think, you know, like the Florida Project, its point is when you've gone so far down, you literally have nothing to lose. And you're so close to that point of desperation that eventually you will try to break free from it. And that's right. What happens out of
that. That's not actually dissimilar to the Gully theme in some ways.
Mm. Yeah. The movie has a very curious visual look. I wasn't a fan of the camera work, which is very shaky at times, but the movie is almost constantly bathed in these yellows and reds, and most of the movie is shot in the dark. So it has a very sordid kind of visual look as well, which kind of matches the story a little bit.
Okay.
So by no means is this a happy film. But again, the more, even as I'm talking right now, I continue to see a lot of similarities with the Florida Project.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Seems to be a lot of these movies being made about like the underbelly of different places at the moment. I'm seeing more and more of those forgotten people in some ways.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a whole subplot involving Cynthia Nixon's son, who also is in on abusing these girls, not abusing them like physically, but kind of, you know, encouraging them to steal and involvement of drugs. And it really gets pretty dark.
Is there hope?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just curious. Yeah, no, I mean, Gully had this, you know, very dark shadow over the whole thing with its kind of coffee-colored filtered look, and it felt very bleak. But okay, yeah. Stray Dolls. Movie number three, then, is The Short Story of the Long Road.
And I have the intro to that one. Okay, so this is teenage Nola grew up living out of a van with her charismatic father, Clint, two nomads against the world. But when tragedy strikes, Nola must confront the reality of life on the road alone. She'll need to take the wheel for the first time, learning to own her grief, her past, and her new destination. And playing in the title role is Sabrina Carpenter, who some of you may know from Girl Meets World. I think she's a very talented actress, and she's trying to make a name for herself, I think, in the non-Disney part of the world. And it also stars Stephen Ogg, Danny Trejo, and Maggie Siff. So, Joe, you are the only one of us who saw this.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Sabrina Carpenter, I can't say I know her extremely well, but Rashmi, you're a big fan of the Girl Meets World series, and so I've seen a lot of it by default as a consequence of that. And I've always felt that she has kind of talent to spare.
Yeah. You know,
she carries that show to a great deal. And I felt that way too with this movie. She really excels in this role. And ultimately, you know, it's our belief in her and her performance that carries this kind of road movie from place to place. It feels, in many ways, you know, the opposite of the kind of America that we've just talked about in our last two movies, where it's a road movie. And you can imagine the kind of plot points that spring to mind when you think about a miner on her own in a camper van,
yeah,
traveling across America on her own. This movie doesn't go to, you know, the kind of the super dark places. There's actually a lot of hope. She encounters people who, you know, will be are genuinely helpful,
like,
to her.
Lean on Pete, right?
And mm-hmm.
Seeing as we were talking about,
yeah.
You know, give somebody who is kind of down on their luck, you know, just enough of a helping hand, yeah. to get them from where they are to the next phase of their journey. So as a road movie, it paints, and I won't say it's a sanitized picture of America, it isn't. It's just a reminder that, you know, considering that we've seen these movies with such despair,
yeah.
all around the country, that even people with not very much can be helpful to others in ways that are meaningful. And so in that respect, the movie has kind of a warm and fuzziness to it. You know, it certainly flirts with this precious view of America, but it stays on the right side of it. The movie doesn't ever cross over into that kind of annoyingly, you know, pat territory that something like this could easily fall into. And it's also, you know, surprisingly free of excess sentimentality. So, you know, on the other side of that, you could get into this kind of excessively fluffy movies. This girl has a lot to deal with, her, you know, it's not a spoiler per se, it's in the intro, but you know, we lose her father from the story very early on in the game, and then, you know, part of her journey here is to try and track down you know, the potential other parent that she has in her life. And so, you know, getting through some of that, and you know, ultimately how that whole story plays out is not in the Disney-fied way that the movie sometimes presents itself as being. So a huge heart to this movie. I really do credit Sabrina Carpenter for the way that she plays this role, the way that she helps us buy and believe in the struggles, internal struggles that the character has to kind of contend with here. And, you know, it was just a very enjoyable road movie with, you know, some generally positive themes. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't resolve itself in a way that's, you know, very Disney-esque or anything like that. But it's certainly a solid movie with lots of heart and superb, you know, entertainment value. So I like this one an awful lot. It's very child-friendly, like I say, not because it's sugarcoating the world, but because it deals with its material and themes in a way that are, you know, both adult and you know, not necessarily, you know, dark and bleak and you know, hopeless as you know, sometimes the world can be shown. So yeah, I like this one an awful lot. Moving on then, we go to the movie Rewind. So Yazdi, I think you can tell us about Rewind.
Yes, Rewind is playing in competition in the documentary section, and it's directed by Sasha Joseph Neulinger. And essentially, it's an unflinching personal narrative that reconstructs the unthinkable story of director Sasha Joseph Neulinger's boyhood and bravely exposes the dynamics of abuse as it passes through generations. So this looks like heavy stuff, and even as I was reading up this introduction, I was trying to recollect the name of a movie, which very similar movie, which was released, I want to say, almost a decade ago, which was the director pieced together little phone messages and little videos he had of his life with his mom, and that too dealt with abuse and so forth. And if I remember the name of the documentary, I'll bring it up. But this kind of reminded me of that. Rashmi, you were the only one who saw it?
I know, and I was kind of kicking myself in some ways because I walked into this one straight after Gully. So I had a rather sort of heavy morning. Okay, so this is really important, okay? 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will be abused before they are 18 years old. And 90% of the people will know their perpetrators. That's wow. Horrible. That's horrific to me. So rather like At the Heart of Gold, Joe, that you and I watched about the abuse, you know, the systemic abuse. By
the young gymnasts.
Yeah, of the gymnasts. This story is written and directed by the person who is the victim. And basically, he had a father who was obsessive about taking home video. And so there are archives and archives of these videos. And basically, what's interesting about them is that many of them are shot around the time that the victim's actually being abused or is about to be abused. And it's kind of happening in the background. And then you're seeing...
So this is real life footage.
This is real life footage. And it doesn't show the abuse. In the
same time period as correct. The abuse, but obviously correct. Not depicting correct. The abuse.
But it will be like Thanksgiving. And then you see the abuser and the victim in an area of the house going about their business. But you know that the abuse has happened or is about to happen. And really, it's a very brave story. And... I think there must be some form of like catharticism that this filmmaker is undergoing as he interviews his mother and his father, because obviously their marriage failed as a result of this. And what we find out is that his own father was abused by the same people, right? So it was abuse that his father faced from his brothers. And then, you know, there's all of this guilt that goes on because his father was unable to protect his own children. And so what I love about this is, so as a documentary itself, it's very well paced, it's very hard hitting, it's very well put together, it's a great constructed story. But what I think is really important is this filmmaker is trying to say, if I can put this story up, if I can show people that it's okay to speak out against this, then maybe we can change the world. And he's doing a lot now for, you know, abused children, advocacy groups. And as a result of this case, some of the processes by which abused children have to face their perpetrators has changed also.
Wow.
So it's an important story. Like legally. So, you know, apparently in the old days, if you were a victim, you had to be seen by all of these different groups. So the police had to do their group. Then the social worker would come and do their group. The hospital would come in and do their group. You know, their information. And now what's happened is there's certain ways that now the victim only has to speak once. And if you are one of those parties who are interested in getting the information, you get to see that information at the same time.
Rather than the kid having to relive correct. The experience over
again and again and,
over
and again and again. Yeah. So I think this was an incredibly sad, difficult story to tell. But, you know, I'm so happy for the filmmaker himself that he's come out of the other end of it and kind of been able to sort of piece his life back together again, and as with his parents and his sister as well. So I hate to say I enjoyed documentaries like this because they're so difficult to watch, but these are just important stories to tell, and everyone should watch them, not only because they're important, because we just go about our lives and have our heads buried in the sand. I think, you know, I think if you can see signs, or someone who has children or is exposed to children can see any of these signs happening, and they are there vivid in plain sight if you want to look for them. And I think that was what was most frightening, is that because he'll show a piece of footage and he'll say, well, what were you thinking right at that minute? Or what happened straight after this point? And, you know, his mother would say, well, I came up to the room door was closed. I knocked on the door, but the person who was doing the abusing with such ease and confidence said, hey, we're having playtime. And so she just walks away. And so there were many times that this could have been stopped.
You know, this stuff is heartbreaking to hear. And I think, as is always the case when I hear about these things, and as we heard about the US gymnastics, you know, how are we failing our kids constantly in such huge, huge ways?
I mean,
you know, we're not parents, none of us here at this particular table, but no, I mean, we've also managed to, you know, get through to adulthood, and hopefully, I think among the three of us have had a little to no exposure of anything of this nature. And it's, you know, given the statistics you quote, it's kind of remarkable.
It is remarkable.
And you know, this shouldn't be happening in the world right now. It's amazing to me that this still happens. And
yeah.
So bravo to the filmmakers there for shining the light onto this. And I think it's important for all of us to understand and be suspicious of the type of abuse that might be happening right under our very noses, so that if we are ever in a situation to do something about it, we can. Wow, heavy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But sounds like it was
Well worth a watch.
Definitely. And hopefully something that, again, we'll get to see the light of day with some distribution, because this stuff's always important enough to get out of there. Yeah. So, okay, let's move along then. Our next movie to discuss is the movie Clementine. So, Rashmi, I think
I have that one.
For Yazdi, who I think was the only one of us that saw Clementine.
Okay, so in this moody and mysterious narrative feature, a scenic lake house becomes a sanctuary for two young women. So Karen, played by Otmara Marrero, 29, is just out of a long-term relationship and needing a place to lick her wounds. So she sneaks into her ex's summer home, and there she meets the precocious Lena, or Lana, played by Sydney Sweeney, whose bold charisma is a welcome distraction. Both Karen and Lana are emotionally guarded, but their cautious flirtation brings each of them a sense of validation. This looks right up Yazdi Street. Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know there's a genre.
It's very looks very fruity.
No, it's not fruity at all. I didn't realize there's this genre of movies that I love, which I like to call like the log cabin movies, where, you know, characters somehow get together in this remote location somewhere, and they are kind of in that location, and everything plays out there. Where, you know, like unusual characters get together. And here's a situation where this lead character, Karen, she's come there because she's had a recent breakup, and she's actually wants just to clear her head, and she actually breaks into the home of her ex, you know, just to get, you know, clear her head, like I said. And then she kind of is almost accosted by this much younger girl who is her neighbor, who kind of, you know, forces herself into her life during that time. And, you know, it's about the interaction between two. So, you know, for example, there was the movie we all love, Martha Marcy, May Marlene.
Yes.
There was a movie called Your Sister's Sister.
Yes, which was amazing.
All of these amazing movies, which are all about unexpected characters being forced together in a remote location. And I love these movies, I've learned. So here's one more in that entry. I'd really give this movie a lot of credit, because there's nothing cookie cutter about it. There's nothing remotely, you know, generic about it. At every step, the movie is different and unusual, and you don't really know where it's headed. And it's just very, very authentic. The plot kind of almost takes the strand that it wants to, but along the way, slowly you find out things about people. It's exceptionally well acted, very deftly handled. It's not for everyone. I think this is the kind of movie where some people will be like, what's going on? You know, where is this movie going? And what they might complain about, I found that very nourishing and enriching, and I was just fascinated by the whole thing.
And is that because the plot is somehow opaque? Does it require you to kind of put things together?
No,
or
to
is
the
it
movie's,
frustrate?
No, to the movie's credit, okay. In the last 10 minutes, you find out everything about everybody to a reasonable extent.
Okay.
But until you get to that point, it's constantly playing this game of with the viewer that you know where this movie is headed, but that's not where it's going to go.
Right.
You know, you think that these two women are going to become best buddies, but they won't. You think these two women might develop some kind of a sexual relationship, but they don't. So it's kind of constantly kind of playing with you. And I really like how it slowly unfolds. So the script is really very nicely done. And I think there's literally like three main characters in the movie. There's the girl, and then the younger girl who runs into it. And then there is a man. Well, there's a man who gets sent there by her ex to check up on her, because the ex is worried that she's so depressed that she might do something to herself. Mm-hmm. So those three characters kind of play the main role. It's quite something. It's very delicate as a movie. I loved it. I really loved it.
Just from the description, it just sounds like a Yazdi movie. So.
Yeah, it's got a lot of atmosphere. It's got, I don't know, it's fun. It's fun because it's so utterly unpredictable at every step, and excellent acting. In the final revelations, it was very moving, actually.
Terrific stuff.
Yeah.
Great. Next movie on our list to discuss today is the movie Flawless. So again, this is one that Rashmi and I were able to see a part of the evening, and this was the world premiere, so we did get to participate in the audience Q&A. with the director and a couple of cast members. So, Yasdi, why don't you tell us about Flawless, and then we'll tell you what we thought.
Okay, so Flawless is playing in the International Narrative Competition at Toronto, and it has two directors, Sharon Maimon and Tal Granit. And it's a movie which comes from both Germany as well as Israel. I believe it is set in Israel. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong.
It is, yeah.
It is. And essentially, it's about three teenage girls in search of physical perfection that are drawn down a dark path of black market plastic surgery, which leads to an impulsive adventure that ultimately becomes a journey of self-discovery. So that sounds a lot, actually, to me, like the movie Mustang we were talking about earlier, but maybe not. So tell us. Incidentally, there was a movie with Robert De Niro called Flawless, which came out 15 years ago.
Okay.
But anyway,
not that
this one. Has nothing to do with that.
Yeah. Nothing to do with
yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that intro and logline is what, you know, we had to go on as a description going into the movie. So, you know, I was expecting to see, you know, kind of an angst-ridden teenage flick that went into dark territory. Instead, what we got was this movie is anything but lighthearted. It's not lighthearted. It handles an extraordinarily difficult topic exceptionally well. It's smartly scripted, insightful, quippy dialogue. It's tonally a lot lighter than one might suggest from that log line. But, you know, and I'll get right there. I mean, this involves a transgender character who is dealing with, you know, transgender issues in the school environment. And you can imagine if you almost take the movie Mean Girls and transport mm-hmm. The character into that world, exactly the type of bullying and you know, difficulties that somebody might have in high school. But along with Mean Girls, you know, it handles those issues with, you know, a kind of a light touch, which gets the point across incredibly well without taking us into super depressing territory, but also allows the character to explore and prevail and you know, deal with many of the issues that she is facing. So I've butchered that in so many ways because I feel like the movie, to its credit, it's just so well crafted. Rashmi, why don't you take a few words while I gather my thoughts on this?
Sure.
And I forgot to mention in my introduction, the longer introduction does mention that transgender model Strashko delivers a star-making performance as Eden, the girl with most to hide, but also the most to gain in her search for validation. So
yeah, so this is a note perfect depiction of teenage angst, shame,
self-esteem,
search for perfection, yeah, self-esteem, self-worth, and then it layers on this character who is transgender. So to me, the beauty of the movie is that whether you're transgender or you have a big nose or you have no boobs or you're not muscly enough or you're not butch enough, if you're a boy, all of those issues.
Stop talking about me.
I know, I was trying not to look at you when I said that, Yasdi. You know, all of those things are so perfectly captured in a beautifully paced narrative that just will melt your heart. And it's got just enough humor, even though it goes to some really dark places, it kind of keeps you on the journey and has you rooting for these three sort of ultimately, you know, three musketeers who engage in this, you know, harebrained scheme of selling their kidneys in order to get, you know, the plastic surgery that they so badly want that they think will change their lives forever. But I'll kind of leave it at that. This may be one of the best movies I've seen at the festival. Not because all of the others haven't been so good, but this one manages to capture sort of coming of age. Again, you know, there's a lot here. There's a lot it's talking about. It beautifully also captures, I think, the angst of the parents who have a trans child, because when do you know that this is a phase that someone's going through versus, you know, making that choice of having, you know, gender reassignment surgery and the irreversible nature of that, or the irreversible nature of any surgery when you're that young. But it's just whoever did the translations, again, very quippy. I like the word you used there, Joe. So just a wonderful, wonderful movie and great acting. Great acting by all the leads in this.
Sorry, I missed that.
It has the perfect trifecta. Yes, you talk about this. It's extraordinarily well written. It's directed with just the right touch. You know, we have...
And this is a co-directing team, right? Mm-hmm.
We have emotional moments. We have funny moments. We have... some dark moments, we have tender moments, all of that, that's kind of in here, but none of them are overdone. And it's not constantly shifting tone either. It all just fits well within the universe. And then performances, this movie lives and dies by its casting, particularly the main role of Eden. And they were saying in the director's Q&A that they tried actually casting this movie for a long time within Israel. And, Israel's a small country, small population. They don't have a huge number of actors. And when looking for somebody with this kind of breadth to play a role like this, they just couldn't find somebody. So they literally said, we can't make this until we do. And then they came across this this model. I think she was featured in Teen Vogue by the name of Stav Strashko. And this movie literally is, I won't say it's carried by her, because all of the supporting performances are absolutely
I would call it three leads, to
the way that this movie plays out. But without this person who is stunningly beautiful, it works so well, because we buy the nature of the character and what she's going through. So, I really can't say enough good things about this movie. It took me by surprise, and I knew from the first few minutes that we were in for something special just by how clever the dialogue was working for me, and how this one has won awards in Israel. I can see it picking up certainly a lot of kudos within its own community, but this is also a mainstream movie that anyone with kids should watch. Just if you've got kids in high school, then understand that this is what their world can be like, and understand that the growing up with any of these issues is going to be a challenge for both parents and children.
I thought the opening scene is literally a school corridor and a man on a horse walking through the corridor. Mm. So I was almost thinking, oh no, what are we in for? But it just unfolds into this beautiful story.
Yeah. So flawless.
I'm glad to see that the US has done such a great job of exporting Prom around the world.
Okay, so from Flawless onto our final movie of the day, which is Georgetown. And I think, Yazdi, you're the only one of us that saw Georgetown. But Rashmi, if you could...
I am, yes.
Take it away.
So Ulrich Mott, an ambitious social climber, marries a wealthy widow in Washington, D.C. in order to mix with powerful political players. This not only stars Christoph Waltz, but it is his directorial debut. And he is... co-starring with Annette Bening, Vanessa Redgrave, and Corey Hawkins, amongst others. And I really wanted to watch this one, not just because I love Christoph Waltz, but interesting that he's directing now. So, Yazdi, what did we miss?
So, Joe, you and I have talked about this many times. Christoph Waltz is a director's actor, meaning that he needs to be in the hands of a very strong director to bring out the best in him. And it's interesting that the two Oscars that he's won, both for Best Supporting Actor, have been in Tarantino movies. And when he's with directors who are not as strong, he fails to rise to the occasion, so to speak. I mean, he's by no means a bad actor, but he's not as...
He's Oscar winning.
Twice, yeah. So I was very curious...
But he seems to be always Christoph Waltz.
Yeah, he always seems
to be in a different Christoph costume. Waltz.
Except in Tarantino movies.
Correct. Except in Tarantino movies. So I was very curious as to what his directorial venture would look like, first directorial venture. And, like they say in real estate, the three things that matter are location, location, location. I think in cinema, the three things that matter is plot, plot, and plot. And I think Waltz has been very, very shrewd to pick a story which is so remarkable that if you just get out of the way and tell the story, then that alone is enough. So it's based on a New Yorker article called The Worst Marriage in Georgetown. And it's based on this marriage between very, very popular writer and journalist who was about 9 years old, and she married somebody who was 50 at the time. It's fascinating. I mean, I think the movie starts with the title card that it's not actually based on real events, but it's highly inspired by them.
Okay.
But it's got a terrific cast. Vanessa Redgrave plays the older wife who is, you know, approaching 9 years old. Christoph Waltz plays her younger husband. And then Annette Bening plays Vanessa Redgrave's daughter, who kind of is very suspicious about why her mom is getting married in her late 80s and what does this man stand to gain from her. And the performances across the board are tremendous. But I think as the movie goes on, you kind of watch like, is this for real? Is this man just being wrongly accused because he has a true friendship with this woman?
Mm-hmm.
And then after the halfway point, the movie kicks into high gear and the plot just plays out. I suspect a lot of it is based on how things unfolded in reality. And it is so good at that point. It's just a joyride. And I think it almost gets into the Wolf of Wall Street territory in terms of how much a person can get away. Or even another Leonardo DiCaprio movie, Catch Me If You Can, about how much a person can surprise you and how clever they can be.
The illusion versus the real.
The illusion versus the real.
Love those
and
movies.
Christoph Waltz plays that character and he does an amazing job with it. And Annette Bening has not such a big role, but she's always so committed.
So good.
You know, she is, you know, the stern character who's convinced that her elderly mom is being taken advantage of. And she will, you know, at any cost, you know, not back down and try to find out what's behind that. It's just a joy. I mean, I always worry about these high profile names and, you know, name movies where I'm like, maybe, you know, it's a mess, but this one I'm so happy to report is not a mess. I hope this movie gets a wide release because it needs to be watched just to be believed. It's quite something.
Fantastic. And I hope it, with that, certainly with that cast and hopefully it's gotten some decent backing, we will get a chance to see that somewhere.
Yeah, and it has got some really good flourishes with the camera work, you know, with how things have been filmed, how information is revealed to us. There are these title cards where you find out the whole movie.
How Tarantino-esque.
It's very Tarantino, where it starts with him being an intern, then him becoming the butler, then him becoming the husband, then him becoming, you know, different things at every point. And slowly you find out information about it. It's a joy.
Terrific stuff. Great. And yeah, just before we wrap up today, so that was the final movie that we had covered in for the podcast today. But Rashmi and I, one of the reasons
you did
see so many more movies than the two of us today was Rashmi and I were escaped to a different part of New York to attend an audience.
To eat ice cream.
Well, among other things, yeah. We did sneak a baguette lunch from a supermarket, so that's why I have half a pound of butter in my my bag for the day, but that's another story. We escaped to Beacon Theatre in the Upper West Side of New York to attend an audience with Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro, which, you know, if you attend film festivals, oftentimes you get the opportunity to sit down with filmmakers. They have an audience and a microphone or a panel of actors, filmmakers, directors, cinematographers, screenwriters, producers. You know, there's a whole mixed bag of them. And you know, sometimes they're the very famous ones, and sometimes it's just, you know, people that you've never heard of, editors talking about their craft. So it's one of the things that I've
done the best movies that you love, right?
It's one of the things I really enjoy about film festivals is, you know, looking, peeking behind the curtain and seeing how the sausage is made at times, and you know, listening to passionate people talk about what they're most passionate about, which is filmmaking. So Martin Scorsese needs no introduction at all to anyone listening to this podcast, and Robert De Niro likewise.
Has he made some good films? Who is this guy?
Yeah, who's that shyster? He clearly is one of the living greats of cinema today, and he and De Niro basically sat down in a couple of armchairs on a stage in front of a couple thousand people and chatted like old friends. And it's remarkable, A, to see just how long the two of them have been in each other's lives. I think they credit each other with each other's success.
Yeah.
They also have a great deal of admiration for
each other,
the work that each of them does. So it was really nice to kind of see that play out in front of an audience. It was very, very natural, unforced. And, you know, they weren't, you know, puffing up each other's egos. They were just talking about the work that they did. You know, great.
It literally was like hanging out with two people who love and respect each other and love working together. And it would be like, yeah, remember that guy, you know, who was with us in that room, and then we did that thing, and then he told us to do that other thing, and then we went and did that, and then that turned out really funny. Or remember that time when you took me to that fan's house because this man was writing to you about, you know, wanting to see you, and remember how we incorporated that into that movie then?
So it no was one person... just
beautiful.
So no one person was interviewing the other?
Well, I think it was supposed to be, you know, Bobby asking questions of Marty, and instead
just became a conversation.
Mr. De Niro is actually very shy and almost awkward a little bit on the stage until he found something that he could hook into.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like Scorsese is just so encyclopedic when it comes correct. To his knowledge of film and
you could say one word and let him go,
and of the process. So he just had so much to kind of tell us about his.
And
his,
I think they picked their favorite clips between them, right? So we saw a bit of Raging Bull, we saw a little bit of The King of Comedy, a bit of Wolf of Wall Street. Leonardo DiCaprio was in the audience, so they
singled him out, which was quite funny
because he was in disguise.
I think he was there kind of incognito,
correct?
But
a lot of, I believe this is kind of like a pre-build-up to The Irishman, which is the film that they've collaborated on again. I believe it's going to come out next year sometime. My guess is it's going to be another mobster movie. We talked a lot about, or we heard a lot about, the reason why we always see a lot of the mob-type movies is that it was really the early influences of Martin Scorsese's life. So he grew up, he's a born and raised Lower East Side
New Yorker
who basically absorbed the city and absorbed the atmosphere, and it's played such a big part in his life. Like, he knows so much about that topic.
And many of his early movies are focused in that world, specifically because it's what he knows.
You
know, the characters that came to life on the screen were, you know, and he said, you know, that these were people that he knew. You know, they were portraying people that they knew. They offended a lot of people
because,
you know, these characters were, you know, said and did things that real people they knew would do. And I think the thing that struck me was, you know, Scorsese we tend to think of as kind of a master craftsman in terms of film. And he absolutely is. I mean, nothing appears on the screen by accident in a Scorsese films. He intends for it to look and feel and sound that way. But I think the surprise to me was just how improvisational some of his early work was.
Yeah.
In particular, because, you know, when he works with good actors, he is the kind of director that's not so insecure as to ignore what they're telling him.
Yeah.
And, you know, De Niro came to him with an idea for the character of Raging Bull. And in many ways, he co-directed and you know, he may not be credited as the director of Raging Bull, but there were aspects of that character that he literally did off the cuff, improvisationally, because they had been speaking about it at lunch, you know, 4 weeks before the shoot. And they said, you know, we need...
Same with Mean Streets.
We need to do this. Yeah. We need to bring this out. Mean Streets was... in fact, that's the scene that they opened with. And also King of Comedy. You know, there were just ideas that They are true collaborators.
That I didn't realize how much, you know, I thought it was very much Robert De Niro likes acting in Martin Scorsese movies, but it's, you know, it seems like somewhat of an equal, the film exists because they both come together on it.
Look, they trust each other and there's no ego involved in the craft of the final product. Like, I think the best idea wins, and that's the way that true collaboration should work. So,
yeah, I think Scorsese has his muse, right? So it has been Robert De Niro for a long time, and then more recently it has been Leonardo DiCaprio. And a long time ago, maybe 5-7 years ago,
we went up to
LA where we saw the two of them, Leonardo DiCaprio and Scorsese. It must be quite remarkable as a filmmaker to find somebody who is kind of a co-patriot, you know, from a cinematic perspective, and kind of, you know, be able to bounce off things with trust, hard to find. And when you find it, you stick with it and you keep bringing the same people back in film after film.
The only thing that makes me sad about these audience events is that oftentimes, they're not available in any other form later on. So I do wish that there was a way for folks who aren't able to attend these things to access the material either through, you know, online audio or transcripts or, you know, video. It's kind of too bad that they don't do that. But at the same time, that's all the more reason to get your behind down to your local film festival
where
they do these things.
Yes, do it.
And take advantage of that. It's well worth your while. And if you appreciate a film, which, you know, we know you do because this is minute 57 of a podcast, so about film. And if you're listening still, if you're still here, then, you know, you will get something from these types of events. So definitely do that. And check out your local film fest. If you're in Tribeca before May the 5th, then do try and get down and see a movie or two. Hopefully one of the ones we've spoken about.
Yeah, and there's still many, many, many films which have not been shown up until this point, and they will be shown in the second half of the festival, which runs through the next weekend. Yep. So
if you're intimidated by Film Fest, which, you know, at the end of the day, I think a lot of us can feel that way. I think before we started covering them for Movie Wallahs, I think I was always overwhelmed by the choice of these films about which you know very little other than, you know, a couple of lines of dialogue. Start with the narrative competition movies, right? These are movies that have been curated
by the panels. Yeah, it's a great idea.
That's for me been one of the ways that I've found myself getting a higher hit ratio of things that I like versus things that, are maybe a little more challenging or off the beat.
Experimental,
But that's part of the journey of discovery of a film festival. So, you know, pick something that's in a competition. If you like documentaries, then documentary competition, international or, you know, but do yourself a favor, just try it because it's really a time well spent. All right, wrapping up the podcast for now. We'll probably podcast once more. We have 1 day left of coverage here for Tribeca Film Festival. So with a little luck, Woo-hoo. We can get that podcast out in the not too distant future. It may not be immediately after this podcast is issued, but soon. Until then, thanks very much for listening. Too Many Movies, Too Little Time, as always. A goodbye from me.
Good night from me.
And good night from me as well.